It's Wednesday, January 8th, 2020, and this is KBIA's News of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, back with you for our first show of the new year, along with my Missouri School of Journalism colleagues, Kathy Kiley and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, how we use language in the coverage of the developing conflict with Iran. Did the U.S. assassinate Soleimani? And what does using that word suggest? Facebook has announced a ban on deep fakes, but there are some limitations to that policy that some say keeps it from really having any teeth. And with the start of 2020, our list of New Year's resolutions for the news media going into the new year. But we'll start with the coverage of the killing of Iran's major general, Soleimani. CBS broke into the primetime programming Thursday night, cutting into a rerun of Young Sheldon to announce the act, at which point Congress had not been notified and our government had not yet taken credit for. Soon enough, confirmation that it was the result of an American airstrike on the Baghdad airport. And the developments have been fast and far-reaching from that point, right down to last night's ballistic missile strike that also came as a surprise, though we're finding out today maybe not as much of a surprise.
Yeah, it looks like there may have been an early warning via the Iraqis, and it may have been, this may be an effort by Iran to tone things down, to de-escalate a little bit. We'll have to see. I think the complication, though, is that nothing's ever straightforward in the Middle East, and there are so many actors, not all of them government actors, not all of them under the control of governments. And so we'll see whether this effort to tone things down actually works.
One of the things I noticed last night in watching the Rachel Maddow show was that she kept trying to remind people that there are two stories going on here simultaneously, that this is all kind of happening in a split screen. And in some ways, we've seen a lot of this with each of the politicians and pundits that have been brought on to cable news and even network news to talk about this, that this is all also happening at the same time that the Senate is debating or not what the rules for President Trump's impeachment trial is going to look like too.
Yeah, this is, I mean, in watching the coverage of the assassination or the killing, however you want to describe it.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that in a little bit.
Of Soleimani, what you're seeing here is the lack of trust in the Trump administration in, I would say, in full display. You have Congress, which is saying we weren't notified. You have various political pundits as well as former military pundits out there saying, basically, this could be a problem. Here's how this could play out later. Mm-hmm. Going back to the statement that you just made about the Middle East is dysfunctional as well as unpredictable, and so you don't know whether there are going to be state actors that seek revenge or there's going to be militia that seek revenge. And you've got all of this drama playing out as we try to figure out, are we going to have an impeachment trial or are we not going to have an impeachment trial?
Well, and I think the other question that looms over this is this a wag the dog scenario? Because it vividly recalls to me being the pool reporter about 20 years ago when the Bill Clinton, the then president, was also facing an impeachment trial and was having this kind of hangdog vacation up in Martha's Vineyard. And suddenly, we were all wearing shorts and flip-flops, dressed appropriately for the going out to cover the president play golf. And we were called into the press briefing room and told we were getting on a plane and flying back to Washington. And we walked into the White House briefing room, attired for golf, and there was the president announcing he had bombed what he said was a facility of terrorists. And there was a lot of suspicion then, and I think, you know, I've certainly seen in some of the coverage a lot of suspicion now that this is an effort to distract from the matters at hand before the U.S. Senate.
And I find it interesting because before the assassination, the conversation had sort of centered on more Pelosi and McConnell and how the two of them were either negotiating or not negotiating, how this was going to play out. And, you know, Trump was sort of, in many ways, on the sideline in this, you know. And
watching the ping pong ball go back and forth.
Absolutely. And I'm like, wait a minute, this sort of works for him, because as long as the two of them are having it out, then he can sort of dance over here in the corner, but it doesn't work
for him if he's, we know Donald Trump is somebody who does not like not being the center of attention.
So
he's put the spotlight right back on himself.
Right.
So Kathy, you had mentioned in talking about what was going on 20 years ago with Clinton, you were brought into the White House press briefing room. That hasn't happened in this case. In fact, it has been 303 days since there has been any activity coming from that briefing room. Is the administration making a mistake in how it's handling the rollout of whatever official information there might be to share?
Well, I think, this gets to the point we were just discussing. President Trump is not somebody who enjoys having other people be his spokespeople. He wants to be at the center of attention. Now, obviously, and he wants to be calling the shots and making the statements.
But you mentioned Clinton was the one at the podium.
He could have been the one at the podium. But what you will not see, I mean, President Trump has come out, he's made statements, he made another one today. He's willing to make statements. What he's not willing to do is take questions. That's the big difference, I think.
I think he's not willing to take questions, and he doesn't provide a lot of information. He provides a lot of rhetoric. He provides a lot of patriotic language about what he's doing, but he's not going to provide a lot of information to sort of back up the decision that he made. And that's what's really, I think, causing a lot of problems within Washington. And it also feeds into this level of mistrust about what he did and why he did it, because he's not been able to back it up. Now, you've had other presidents that haven't released a whole lot of information, but they at least have released enough to where there's some sort of justification for the actions that they took.
The normal procedure would be, even if it's only to give a few minutes advance notice, even if it's a very brief advance notice, but normally a president would notify members of the leading members of Congress, the leaders of Congress,
the intelligence
people who
committees.
Run the intel committees, and the armed services committees. That did not happen here.
So there have also been comparisons, especially with the punditry and some of those conversations that have been going on cable news with the start of the coverage of the Iraq War in 2003, and that we're seeing a lot of that same immediate step up of patriotism and support for the act. Talk for a minute about whether you see those same similarities, or if there is anything we've learned maybe from some of those acts from 2003 of the lack of skepticism maybe on some of the information that's come through.
Well, I think you're not seeing a lack of skepticism. I think you're seeing a lot more skepticism in this instance than you've seen going back to 2002, but even some of the other, even the skepticism around a lot of the drone bombings that took place under the Obama administration, the situations that Bush went in, both in Afghanistan and in Iraq, there was some skepticism, but not nearly the level of skepticism that you're seeing today. And I think a lot of it goes back to there is a heightened level of mistrust around this president that in many ways he has sort of not just participated in, but has brought on himself.
I also think it's partly a learning process. I certainly think I was in Washington during the run-up to the Iraq War, and it was very tough, I will tell you, to get even quotes from the very few members of Congress who were willing to speak up with some skeptical notes. It was hard to get that in the paper because there really was almost this Jones for war. And I think a big part of that was it was the immediate aftermath of 9/11. Mm-hmm. You know, we weren't that far away from 9/11, and people were afraid to seem unpatriotic. I think having gone through that experience, seen that it may be the results were not that great for the United States of America or the American people, you're seeing some. It's some of the backlash is Trump, but some of it is really the experience of the Iraq War. And you know, it was interesting in one of the pieces that we have up on the blog. Barbara Slavin, who's a former mm-hmm. colleague of mine from USA Today, and who really knows a lot about Iran, has a great line. She said, revenge is not a strategy. Right. And I think that's the kind of sentiment that was much harder to get into the media back in the early 2000s. Now you're seeing it within 24 hours after the president acts. So that to me is a big difference. The similarity though, mm-hmm. and this is something that I think the media has to be very cautious about. Also in one of the pieces you posted to the blog, Amy, it quotes somebody on Twitter saying, the cable news is hardwired to favor war. And I think that's true because
it gives them content.
It gives content. Mm-hmm. It provides drama. Mm-hmm. Right. There's an arc, a narrative arc. And it's awfully tempting to fall into that. And I think for the media, one of the things that we have to do is to be really careful that we're not letting our commercial interests or our dramatic interests override our news judgment.
So, Ernest, one of the words that you had used several times, as others have on cable news and elsewhere, to describe this act was assassination. And there has been some discussion out there, some critique, that perhaps that word may or may not be loaded because of the definition of murder that is attached to that, and that murdering another not necessarily head of state, but government official, is an act of war. It's a violation of international
law. I disagree with that.
Okay, go
for it. I disagree with that for two reasons.
Okay.
One, if you are going to execute a murderer, mm-hmm. you have to have a judicial process to precede that. So that murderer has to be convicted, number one. That did not happen here. Number two, if it's an act of war, you have to have a declaration of war,
which
we have not had. Now, Mizzou alum Tim Kaine mm-hmm. has introduced a resolution that would
not
require that. But he started it as a journalism
yes.
major. And it just went kind of off track. But at any rate, I think there is a lot of pressure for that. But mm-hmm. absent those two things, mm-hmm. I don't have any problem. I think, you know, we as Americans don't like to be perceived as doing things like assassinations, but we did. I looked it up. The Webster's New World Dictionary definition of assassination is to murder a usually prominent person by sudden or secret attack, often for political reasons. I went further. Roget's Thesaurus, the synonyms are purge, liquidate, eliminate. Synonyms for assassination. Eliminate is exactly the word yeah. that the president used when he described what happened. So Trump, in his statement, when he announced this, said it was a flawless precision strike that killed the number one terrorist anywhere in the world. That, to me, is an assassination. It was an assassination ordered by a U.S. president. You know, you've got to be, we're journalists. You have to call out what it is. You can't, I think limiting the use of language and softening and, mm-hmm. and using euphemisms is something we tell our students not to do. Yeah. So
we
shouldn't do it.
But
we
I mean,
do.
And here's the thing, we've used that term over and over again as journalists, whether we were talking about someone who is a political figure, as in this case, yeah. a political and military figure, or someone who's even the head of a terrorist organization. We've used the word assassination. Now, they're not part of a government, a sanctioned government, as we would call it. But then again, they were seen as a political figure and the head of a major organization. And we've called that an assassination.
Not a bad guy.
Yes,
yeah. He's a bad guy. He was a
yeah.
bad guy.
Yes, absolutely.
But if you're going to execute him, you have to have a judicial process.
Right.
If it's an act of war, you have to have a declaration of war. We didn't have either of those
right.
things.
Okay.
So it's an assassination.
Okay. One thing we do have in covering this conflict that maybe we didn't in 2003 or going back to the Clinton administration, is the involvement of social media in this as well, and some of the misinformation that can come into social media, which then also distracts journalists, taking them away from covering the conflict to correcting the misinformation. Two very specific examples that we've seen was a congressman that was circulating a photoshopped image of Barack Obama meeting with somebody who wasn't the president of Iran. Another one, something that was floating out there, creating a lot of fear and anxiety among young people that were told that because of their filling out the FAFSA, the form that qualifies them for federal financial aid to pay for college, that that immediately enrolled them in the selective service that
and
would make them
up higher on
that
the
bumped
list.
Them higher up on the list for the draft that a Donald Trump parody account tweeted was going to begin tomorrow, Thursday into Friday, creating a lot of unnecessary fear that college students were going to be bumped up and drafted in the middle of all of this.
And I think you point out something that's really important, is that the news media mm-hmm. is going to have to spend an awful lot of time tracking down this misinformation and debunking this misinformation, while at the same time trying to provide accurate information in a contextual way. And that's going to be awfully difficult, especially in a 24/7, 365 environment in which people are getting their news and information in bites as opposed to full contextual stories. So it's going to take not just the news media doing this, but it's also going to take citizens actually paying attention to what it is that they're reading, what it is that they're viewing, and questioning whether or not there's some validity to it. Mm-hmm. So it can't be this one-way street in which everyone is dependent upon the news media to provide this, because there are some bad actors out there, and they're going to continue to do this kind of thing. And the citizens, it's up on them to say, well, wait a minute now, come on. The draft, really?
You know. But that's also one of those things, though, that there is so much confusion about and so much fear about the Vietnam era and people being drafted and what that meant in the end of the draft, that people are going to immediately have that a visceral response to even the misinformation that the draft could come back.
Well, and the visceral response is what people have to learn to transcend, mm-hmm. because I think Ernest is absolutely right. It's important, and the media will check these things out and will debunk them. But I think part of, and we've talked about this before on the show, part of media literacy is understanding and learning how the most primitive parts of our brains can be manipulated. They can be manipulated by bad actors. They can be manipulated by the media themselves for commercial reasons. So I think one of the things that, in a world, you know, with every right and every privilege comes a duty. And with the privilege of having access to all of this information, readers now have to spend more time doing the kinds of things that journalists have always done, which is take a deep breath. What's the source for this story? Is it a legitimate source? What are other people saying? Are there members of Congress saying that the draft is being reinstated? If not, maybe you want to, think twice before you retweet that. So I think a lot of this is going to be a process of public education and people empowering themselves not to get played.
Not to get played, too.
Right. I think the other issue here is that when you continue to have this happen over and over again, it's misinformation, people check out. I mean, they just completely check out. And they're not going to pay attention to anything. And I think that's the real threat, or one of the real threats to democracy, is that people are just, they're tired of the drama that turns out to be misinformation or flat out lies. Mm-hmm. And then, you know what, I'm not going to pay attention to any of it. And then at that point is where we're going to have people who are just not going to engage in a process that is important to their everyday lives.
Kathy, I didn't get a chance to put this on the Links blog, and frankly, I'm springing this on both of you, but you wrote a piece for the Alumni Magazine, I believe, of your alma mater.
Yes.
That got into this specifically. I loved the analogy that you had in there about getting news only from social media being the equivalent of Doritos, Cheetos, and Ho-Hos. And when I tweeted it out, I mentioned that, like, your doctor is going to tell you those aren't doing you any good. And issued a challenge, as you talk about just this, that people get off of social media, find five news sources that they can go to directly every single day, make that their 2020 resolution, to diversify their news diet, to get that information from reliable sources. The other part I put into that challenge was to have at least three of them be local and to pay for at least two.
Absolutely.
And to make that kind of a charge for the new year.
That's a great challenge. And one of the things I'm going to do in the new year is to make gifts of subscriptions to local news media. And that's going to be my gift to my loved ones. Mm-hmm. Because I think once you start to see what legitimate fact-checked news looks like, it's going to be easier to recognize the bad stuff. I'm not saying Doritos aren't fun. You know, we all like a Dorito once in a while.
But
I think we all instinctively know that we need some whole grains in our diet as well. And we need to get that same kind of wisdom when it comes to our information diet.
Yeah. And when it comes from places that you can trust, things like the 20-second video of Joe Biden that circulated last week that was actually edited and pieced together from things taken out of context, from a speech that was made about the work that he had been doing on behalf of women and women's rights, that somehow became a video that made him look like a rampant racist.
Right. And here's the thing. It's 2020. Mm-hmm. It's election season. Get right. ready for it. Exactly. I mean, you thought 2016 was bad. This is going to be the everyday normal of what's going to happen in this election. So it is really important for the public to check it out, make sure you understand what's going on, question what you're reading, get more than one source, because if you're going to be an informed voter for this election, you're going to have to work at it.
Well, and Facebook is kind of pounding itself on the chest, all proud of a new ban that it has put in place to try and outlaw deep fakes. But there are a lot of loopholes in this that are really making it so that these videos that that we were talking about with Joe Biden, or the one from last spring with that made Nancy Pelosi appear to be drunk at an event, that those are going to get right through. The policy itself, I'm reading from it, says it does not extend to content that is considered parody or satire, which makes sense, or video that has been edited solely to omit or change the order of words. Good is that?
Yeah, and the point is, this is where journalism is great, because mm-hmm. it provides you with context. The social media platforms don't want to do that. They really have not wanted to take the responsibility. They keep saying we're not publishers when they are. And so they just want to put out this content without any context. So again, I don't think readers or viewers or listeners should despair. There are tools out there, and they're accessible and they're easy for you to get. And, you know, we've done some training here at the University of Missouri. We're going to do more. People who are interested in participating can email me. You know, I think we have to tell people that knowledge is power, and you have the ability to discern what is real and what is not. And, you know, the most important app for doing this is the one right here.
And she's pointing to her head.
Between your ears. And so that brain thing. But we can train people to do this. So I think, you know, but I would say that the Greg Sargent piece that mm-hmm. you put on the blog about this deepfakes and the proliferation, mm-hmm. The potential for proliferation in 2020, my only quibble with that piece is he said the Democratic nominees or potential nominees have to be worried about this.
Donald Trump needs
to be especially worried about this. I'm especially worried because, you know, Donald Trump has made an art form of outrage, and that makes him very vulnerable. So if somebody puts something real, you know, Donald Trump saying something really outrageous, like I'm starting the draft again, people would be more likely to believe it because he does tend to pop off. So I think the president, in many ways, is the most potentially vulnerable to these sort of fakes. And that's very worrisome. When you have the voters, you know, if somebody could fake him saying something outrageous that could cause a foreign actor to react, It's very disturbing.
But I also think that it's important for the news media to call that out when it happens. I mean, immediately call it out. I mean, and not just to say, well, the president said this, and we found out later that it was not true. But the first statement out of your mouth was, the president said this. Mm-hmm. You should start off by saying,
attribution
there was a fake.
Yes.
Yeah, that was a fake, something fake put out there.
So as we talk about these things and about the news media needing to do that amid all of the 2019 retrospectives and 2020 resolutions and predictions, it was a collaboration between The Guardian and the Columbia Journalism Review, which asked 30 newsroom and media leaders just how ready they think they are to cover this year's presidential election. And the themes here seemed pretty obvious. We misread how angry the nation was, and we overlooked some of Trump's records of sexual assault and racism and business practices, created the false equivalency with Hillary's emails there, or we didn't pay enough attention to minority groups and then they ended up staying home and not voting. But they didn't really have any good ideas about how to fix that as they move through the next 11 months.
That's because they don't have any. And we're going to run into this same thing again, because mm-hmm. we have to get out of the beltway loop. We have to get out of the horse race way in which we cover elections. And we're still in it. If you've watched any coverage of what's been happening in the Democratic race as it is right now heading into Iowa, it is still that same horse race mentality. It was centered around who's going to get into the debates. Now it's going to be who's going to win Iowa, who's going to win South Carolina.
And there's a reason for that. It's cheap. It's easy and it sells.
Yeah.
So again, we get into this is, yes, the news media needs to alter behaviors, but so do readers, so do consumers. Information consumers need to demand more. And the problem is the long, deep dive stories on important issues aren't getting the same kind of traffic.
No, and in fact, there's a study that's on our Links blog done in part by Tamar Wilner, who is somebody who I met at your Friends of the Facts
and who is a Mizzou
symposium.
Alum.
Yes, at
Missouri
the symposium
made, yes.
here last summer, now studying at University of Texas, has some ideas about what it is based on research that our audiences want. They want context. They don't want jargon. They want follow-up stories. We think we're doing those things, but clearly our audience doesn't.
Well, they don't think that we're doing it because they don't really, a lot of them don't spend the time on that because, as I said earlier, they're getting their news and information in little bites and little chunks, and that doesn't provide what they say they want. It's hard to give them that full story in a 20-second soundbite or in a 40-character tweet.
They say they want the spinach, but they're reaching for the Doritos.
That's right.
That's going to be Kathy's next column. The response. They say they want spinach, but they are reaching for Doritos. Well, that music means we are pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about each of the topics we talked about today. Check out our Links blog. That's under both the programs and podcast tabs at kbia.org. We're also available wherever you get your podcast downloads, including iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again. Leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, making sure we both look and sound good. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music. I'm Amy Simons. We will see you again next week.